Mr. Clark and Mr. Jeffrey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Richard Clark from the Public Defender's Office. I would like to reserve 5 minutes. The standard in this particular case is that when the court reviews the evidence in the light most favorable to the proponent of the jury instruction, the issue in this case is whether one or both of the lesser included jury instructions should have been included and granted and given to the jury. The trial court denied both of those instructions. Quoting the McClung case, which I cite in my brief, if a proffered instruction finds any support in credible evidence, its refusal is reversible error. So this is not a harmless error situation, at least from my position, when the jury instructions were not granted. It's also, quoting McClung, it's immaterial that a jury could have gone to a contrary conclusion. My position in this particular case is they never had an option to look at lesser included offenses because of the denial of the instructions. They were given an all or nothing proposition in this case, either felony murder and child abuse neglect or acquittal. I would ask the court to take the standard in consideration when it makes its ruling in this particular case. One of the cases I'd like to discuss is the Boone case, because I think it is illustrative to the facts that we have in our situation. If you look at the testimony of the appellant in this case, and I'm referring to pages 203 of the appendix through 205. His testimony was after he tried to apply CPR and the child did not respond. His testimony was, I panicked even more. I started hitting him on his chest, hitting his face. I hit him on his sides. Yes, punches. Punches with a balled fist. I was panicking. I didn't know how to react at that time. And then when he was asked directly, well, why did you punch? I was panicking. I was scared. I think that is similar to the type of testimony that you see in the Boone case. In the facts in the Boone case, it was a malicious wounding case where the defense asked for an assault and battery instruction. It was denied by the trial court, and the Court of Appeals overturned that decision and said that the instruction should have been granted. The testimony in Boone, I would argue, is somewhat similar to the testimony that we have in our case. The defendant in the Boone case committed severe injuries on the victim, beat the victim with a 2x4 over the head, and when he testified, he said he panicked when the victim made an advance towards him. He didn't mean to hurt the victim, but he panicked, and that's how he reacted at that point. And I would argue that is similar to the testimony that we have, factually similar to the testimony we have of the appellant in our particular case. Another case that I think is relevant and was argued at the trial court level was the Craig case. That was a case, and essentially what I'm asking for at the trial court level was what the prosecution asked for in the Craig case. They were asking for lesser included offenses in that situation. The defense was the one that was objecting in the Craig case. So they were trying to, it was the defense actually would try to put the defendant in an all or nothing situation. The court, the appellate court said, upheld the granting of the jury instructions in the Craig case. The testimony in the Craig case was essentially the defendant testified he did nothing wrong, that he was driving a car, that he stopped short, and the child was, by the stopping short of the car, there was a movement of the child inside the car. Now, the experts, and it was uncontradicted in the Craig case, said there was no way that that could be what supplied the injuries to the child in the Craig case. That is somewhat similar to what we have factually in our case. The experts in our case all testified that CPR alone would not be sufficient to cause the type of injuries that we saw in our particular case. However, I think my position is that the appellate in my case, the Edwards case, is in a stronger position to get the jury instruction entered than the Commonwealth was in the Craig case, based on the testimony that I just cited from the pages in the appendix, 203 through 205, where he then says he panics and actually delivers bald fist punches to the child in that case. The court held that...
Counsel, let me interrupt you for just a moment, if I may. In this case, Dr. Clayton testified that it was blunt force trauma.
Correct.
That was the cause of the death.
That was Dr. Goff again, supplied the cause of death. But you are correct. Dr. Clayton confirmed that was blunt force trauma. It was the finding that she found in that case. But also, her testimony was that could be supplied by punches. That there was testimony that the appellate hit the child with punches over multiple portions of his body, and her testimony at trial was, yes, that could supply the blunt force trauma. So I think there's even evidence from the prosecution that supports or is consistent with the testimony of Edwards in this particular case, which I think puts myself in a stronger position to get a jury instruction granted, as opposed to in the Craig case where the defendant that testified in that case, essentially he did nothing wrong at any point in the case. I can cite the appendix pages, I believe.
Is it your contention then that the involuntary manslaughter instruction is warranted based on the defendant's testimony that the injuries that the child sustained were as a result of him trying to resuscitate the child?
No. What I'm arguing in this particular situation is that based on the testimony of not just Edwards, but also of the experts, that it's actually the blows are consistent with the findings of the experts. The punches, which is after he tries to resuscitate the child with the CPR, which is the appendix pages 202 through 205.
Is that how you respond to Dr. Clayton's testimony, too, that the victim's injuries were extensive and were not accidental?
Yes. And I think the testimony of Edwards, which is similar to the testimony in Boone, is that it's not accidental, those particular injuries. However, he didn't have the requisite intent to commit those particular injuries to that severity, that's why the jury instruction, as in Boone, should have been granted in our particular case. A couple other things that I wanted to address is there were some other cases that were cited, I think, that can be distinguished from the facts in our case. One is the Leal case. The instruction that was attempted to be introduced was an assault and battery by a mob, not an assault and battery like the one in our particular case. The assault and battery by mob goes to the intent of the mob, not particularly the individual, which I think is different and distinguishable from the facts that we have in our case. Another case that was cited was the Guss case, G-U-S-S. There appears, from reading that particular case, that there was no testimony from the defense in that particular case. They tried to argue in that particular case that the lesser-included offense should automatically be given. And that's not my position here. My position is based on the testimony of Edwards and the parts of his testimony that are consistent with the expert findings that the jury instruction should have been given, and the jury should have had that option. It's a factual issue at that point whether the jury wants to accept the testimony or reject the testimony of Mr. Edwards at that point. But I believe from the evidence that we have that our fact pattern is close enough to both Boone and Craig that they should have been given that option to discuss that. It should not have been an all or nothing proposition for the defense at that point. So at this point, I don't have really anything else I'd like to address. I'll just reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. I do think, as counsel indicated, perhaps thinking about the standards in these cases is probably a good place to start. I would remind the Court, although I didn't really do it on brief, that the Court's jurisprudence and that of the Supreme Court of Virginia is very clear that this is an abuse of discretion standard. There are many cases that get reversed, but at its core, and the Supreme Court has articulated that standard a couple of different ways, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive. They did it in Lawler, and they gave you two or three different ways or four different ways the Court could abuse its discretion, but at its core, what the Supreme Court defined in Grattan fairly recently is that you don't have an abuse of discretion unless reasonable jurists could not differ on the point. If there could be any divide at all, you defer to the trial court's resolution of that legal principle. I think one of the things that's somewhat forgotten in all of this, and this is consistent with what was argued at trial, Appendix 248, and I think it is legally dispositive in this case, the defense has argued that the jury could reject that appellant punched the child in order to revive him and find instead that it was done out of anger as part of assault and battery. And the lead-in to that is the jury could accept or reject parts of a witness's testimony, and in fact, the trial judge did instruct the jury on that principle. That argument, however, is with respect to a jury instruction, is squarely foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decisions in both Leal and Vaughn, which are cited on brief. And the court, there's nothing I'm asking you to infer. The court actually tells us, we recognize that juries are told this. We recognize that fact finders can do this in terms of how they sort out the evidence. But it's a different test with respect to a jury instruction. So I think the only premise that was really offered in support of these instructions, and I would remind the court because I'm going to forget to do this, that the only thing that's preserved with respect to involuntary manslaughter is this related notion that this death occurred as the result of the lawful of the unlawful performance of an act which isn't felonious, i.e. assault and battery. So this is all wrapped up in this notion that this gentleman was entitled to some sort of assault and battery theory instruction. And again, I think because of Leal and Vaughn, the only really arguments that were developed at trial were in this court on that point are foreclosed. I think that's fatal. That's my first point. My second point, and I guess it relates to the first one, is that if you accept his testimony, what he was doing here, and I made this point on brief, what he was doing here was actually attempting to revive this young boy. And in fact, as I've argued on brief, I think that that would be legally justified. It wouldn't be unlawful. It wouldn't be assault. And the standard jury instruction on assault and battery tells you it has to be without justification. I would think it would be a justification as opposed to an excuse. That deals more with mental things like sanity and whatnot. I believe it would be justification, just like defense of a third party or something like that would be. So his version of events, which is what you have to focus on here with respect to the punches, is that he was trying to do something that wouldn't even be assault and battery. So I think the argument falls apart for that premise as well. I think the third point that I would make that I make on brief is also that I think what you're being invited to do here, given the medical testimony in this case, is to isolate a punch, or I think he actually admits to at least two close fist punches, not just one, but let's just assume it's one punch. We've got uncontradicted medical evidence, and as I've argued on brief, that certainly plays into the court's analysis because, as Brandau tells us, it's a case by case. It's very difficult to articulate a test. We've got this evidence in the Commonwealth's case, uncontradicted, multiple blunt force trauma injuries, not just one injury, not just one part of the body. I mean, I defy you as a layperson. Perhaps this wasn't clear from the medical expert's testimony because I don't know that anybody really thought they had to develop it. I mean, we've got blunt force trauma behind, I think, the left ear. We've got it in the abdomen. That's not one blow or one set of violent blows. It's instead a series of violent blows, and there's multiple areas of the body described here. So I think you have that, and I guess the analogy I'm going to use for you is, you know, and this sort of fits into prosecutorial discretion, could we have a murder case where I, as a defendant, walked up and smacked somebody in the face and thereafter shot the person five times and killed the person? Absolutely. Could the prosecutor charge that independent slap as an assault and battery? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean someone like this or somebody like my hypothetical defendant, given the uncontradicted medical evidence in this case, gets an assault and battery instruction. And if the Commonwealth wants to say, yeah, this slap, assault and battery, and we're going to argue this to the jury, in addition to arguing the things we do is with respect to the multiple blunt force trauma, that might work for the Commonwealth, might not be a problem. But, you know, I would remind the court here that there is testimony, the evidence in this record, I think on page, I believe it's 184, one of the medical experts, the second doctor, I believe, talks about that essentially this child wouldn't have been running around like everyone described the child running around if these injuries had been inflicted before the mother left. We, in fact, have testimony, I think, both from the mother and from the defendant, and one of the police officers the defendant talked to, and I'll flag appendix 105, 136, and 199, where even by the defendant's admission, this child seemed to be fine and was running around and before mom left. So that you've got those facts in the record. You've got the admission, even by the defendant's admission in his testimony, and I'm sorry I have misplaced my citations on that, but even by the defendant's admission in his own testimony, he was the... he was the only adult in the house, and the child, this is appendix 132, one of the police officer's testimony, the other child that's there is an infant. So the only adult who's in this house before this child has these violent injuries is this man. And then he turns up, the child turns up severely injured and ultimately dies. With respect to unlawful performance of a lawful act, I've addressed that on brief. I don't think there's any argument with respect to that. I certainly put in a footnote why that would not be well taken in this case as well. I would note for the court that one of the arguments that we considered making, and I usually stick these things down in footnotes just so the court kind of can see that I've shown my work, is that, you know, I don't really know that assault and battery is even really a lesser included offense of this instruction, of this particular statutory murder. In fact, I'm fairly sure it's not. One thing that may skew that a little bit, I mean, counsel has done a nice job flagging the statute for the court, 19.2, I believe it's dash 266.1, it's cited. And that has some unusual language. I think it says something to the effect of lesser degree of homicide, which may be broader than lesser included offense, although I would note for the court, assault and battery isn't really even a homicide crime. I expect at a threshold issue, he may well not fit in within this standard anyway, but given the sort of abundant evidence in this record that the court didn't abuse its discretion, I don't think that's something you have to reach. I would note, too, for the court that that's actually an issue. I cited a U.S. Supreme Court case, Carter, and it's applying federal law, but I think this may still be the rule in Virginia, that they ultimately decided on that very point. These two offenses aren't even lesser included of each other. I don't think you need to reach that because, as I've indicated here today and on brief, there's just abundant evidence that there was no abuse of discretion. I think I don't know that you need to reach harmless error. I would note only that jury instructions are not structural issues. I didn't cite these cases on brief, but certainly in preparing Fong, P-H-O-U-N-G, and Smoot, S-M-O-O-T, and I'm sorry, I didn't get express cites, but I know one's 15 Virginia Appellate and one's 18. Those are actually missing element cases, and that's consistent with U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, I believe, that even a missing element in an instruction can't be harmless. This court in Turner and some other cases has also addressed harmless error in the context of jury instructions, so I think it is certainly something that the court could reach if the court decided to decide the case that way. I think, again, if you look at the facts and the evidence and the medical testimony, even where you define there were more than a mere scintilla here, there's just no chance a jury would have found assault and battery under these facts. And that's my argument. Unless the court has questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In addition to citing 19.2 266.1. I also cited in my brief Puckett v. Commonwealth, which does list the lesser included offenses of murder. It lists it as murder, and it also lists involuntary manslaughter and assault. In addition, I'd just like to address on the testimony of Dr. Gofton. It was on appendix page 74, and it was cause of death was blunt force chest and abdominal trauma, which I would say is consistent with the testimony of Mr. Edwards. In addition, and it was brought up by the trial court judge, a similar argument that was made by the Commonwealth here, that, well, he was trying to help the person, so you can't get in the lesser included offenses. But based on the testimony in pages 202 through 205, he may have started out trying to help the person or help the child in this case. But once he testifies that he panicked, he was scared, and began punching the child, I don't think you can then say that he's still at that point assisting the child. He's doing that not out of helping the child. He's doing it out of panicking and fear is what the testimony was, which I have already said is similar to some of the testimony in the Boone case. In regards to some of the arguments at the trial court level, I'm referring specifically to page 257 of the appendix. It's clear that the argument I was making at that point was that there was more than a scintilla of evidence, so the jury instruction should have been given. It was clear what the judge's ruling was in that situation. He did not agree and said that there was not a scintilla of evidence. So there's no issue as to what the argument was or what the ruling was or any kind of confusion at the trial court level. And once again, my argument is that the jury, it's the province of the jury to be the fact finders in the case. They did not have that option once the jury instructions were given at that point. If given the jury instructions, as I asked, then at that point they could have followed the other instructions that the trial court judge gave, which was to accept and reject parts of the testimony and make a full decision on the evidence as it is. Also, in reference to Dr. Clayton's testimony, and I'm looking at appendix pages 190 through 191. She was given the information, hard punches were done all over the child's body. And she said, certainly, meaning that's blunt force trauma. Punches are one way of inflicted blunt force trauma, which is going back to the cause of death as determined by Dr. Gofton. Another part of Dr. Clayton's testimony, and this is on page 188, it's not possible to determine the sequence of the injuries or the bruises, and she couldn't necessarily put a time frame on that. So I would submit to the court what the evidence we have at that point is in regards to the punches is directly from Appellate Edwards at that point. And I would note that, his testimony is such that the jury instruction should be given. The remedy in this particular case and what I'm asking for in this particular case is a remand for a new trial. All right, thank you.
Thank you. And a Greek council, and that will conclude our morning docket.